You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 271, Exodus 12, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing? I know you had wisdom tooth surgery this week. How'd it go?
Yep. I had oral surgery on Monday, and it was just, what a blast. It's my second wisdom tooth out, so I kind of knew the drill, you know.
So did you have all 4 years?
They put you out for an hour. No, just the one. And I didn't have any pain in it. The reason that they wanted to take it out was it was creating a food trap next to the molar. So they're like, look, if you don't take this out, then your molar could get a big cavity or an infection. So just take it out. So I, you know, okay. Like I said, I've done it once before. It doesn't take long, but it, you know, it's 2 or 3 days of, you know, popping whatever they give you for painkiller and, you know, which puts you to sleep half the time. So
Are you going to make it through the show?
That's what. Oh yeah. Yeah. I ditched the pain medication 2 days ago and just went to ibuprofen. So that doesn't put me to sleep.
Yeah. I still have all 4 of my wisdom teeth. They grew in fine, had no issues. So that's a rarity. But then I had to get one pulled because it got abscessed or whatever it is. I guess it got a cavity. So I just pulled it, but I've got 3 out of the 4, no issues. So I guess that means I got a big mouth or something. I'm not sure.
Two gone, 2 to go.
I don't know what this means, but when they x-ray your teeth, you know, since I have my wisdom teeth in, they have to put this, that the little lead plate or whatever it is to shield your mouth, whatever. And they have to shove it so far back in my mouth that I was gagging last time. And the nurse, you know what she says? She says, that's what you get for still having your wisdom teeth. I go, really? You know, I mean, she was joking with me, but that's the response I get. You know, you're not sorry or, you know, whatever. That's what you get for having your wisdom teeth. It's like, wow, thanks. But, you know.
It's nice that they're looking out for you there, Trey. Yeah,
it's nice of them, isn't it? It's nice of them. But, all right, Mike. Well, Mike, we're still in Exodus 12. You know, we covered it last week, 11 and 12, but we're going to do 2 parts of Exodus 12. So what's that about?
Yeah. Boy, you know, you know, once you get out of Exodus 12, 13, 14, and almost loop 15 into this, listeners have probably noticed that in these chapters, like part of the chapter will be, you know, the last plague and then the Passover. And then we get this little segue, you know, into the people leaving Egypt. Then we come back, you know, in chapter 13 to this, you know, rite of the firstborn thing or the offering of the firstborn. Then we go back to the Exodus. And then we finally, you know, we get the pillar of the cloud. Then we actually get to the crossing. And the crossing, we got to pick up back in chapter 12 because that's where it began. The information is just not laid out in one place. It's scattered through these 3 or 4 chapters. So that's one issue. The other issue is there are just a lot of rabbit trails, problems that you hit here. And we're going to hit 2 of them today, but you know, lucky for us, we get to go back into the quagmire of chronology now. And as if that wasn't bad enough, once we actually get to the crossing of the Red Sea, then we have questions like, well, you know, the Hebrews actually says Yam Suf, the Reed Sea. Is that the Red Sea or is it something different? Does it matter? Is this a literal concept or is it something to do with, you know, chaos, you know, thinking in both on Egypt's side and the Israelite side? What's the route of the Exodus? That actually depends on where the Israelites turn at different points and in what direction. And of course, nobody knows, you know. And so, you know, you get into all these issues. So what I decided to do was today we're going to call this part 1, Exodus 12, because we're not going to get out of Exodus 12 proper. I mean, there's lots of other passages we're going to look at, but that's where we're going to camp. And we're going to cover 2 issues. One is the issue of large numbers in the Old Testament. And the other is going to be the duration of the sojourn, the period of bondage in Egypt. So the second one there is a chronological issue. But we're going to spend enough time on those that we can't actually get into the date of the Exodus. So that's the next time. So that part 2 is going to be just how do the early date defenders defend that position? How do the late date defenders defend that position? So we'll spend a whole episode on the dating problem. And then we'll finally hit the crossing of the Red Sea. You know, we'll loop in the Pillar of the Cloud thing. And again, the information is scattered in several of these chapters. And we'll probably hit Exodus 15 in there too, because that's the Song of Moses, which is about the crossing. I still don't know what to do with the beginning of chapter 13, because that's this offering of the firstborn, which is just sort of thrown in there, or at least that's the way it looks. So eventually we'll, you know, in a few weeks, we'll get to the Red Sea. And then once we're there, we'll have to tackle the whole problem of the itinerary. And of course, that is going to factor into where's Sinai. So we're back to Sinai again. So Sinai and chronology and dating, again, these things are controversies because there's no clear self-evident answer to any of these questions. But again, our job here is just to make listeners aware of that and sort of get down into the nuts and bolts and, you know, see what the items are that scholars discuss. And then we'll just go from there.
Sounds good to me.
So that was a long answer. That was a long answer to your short question.
No, that's okay.
You know, I'm a little vexed by, you know, like, okay, what do I do when and where and why and how and all that kind of stuff. But we're just, you know, this episode is pretty clear cut because we're going to be in essentially a couple of verses in chapter 12. So with that much said, here we go back into chapter 12. And I'm going to read verses 33 through 41. Which in the ESV and lots of other Bibles, you know, they give the header, the Exodus. Well, it's sort of the Exodus, but it's actually the beginning of the Exodus. And the Exodus is going to get picked up later, which again, as I just explained, is part of the problem. But these verses say, this is verses 33 through 41, Exodus 12. The Egyptians were urgent with the people to send them out of the land in haste, which is a great line. I guess so. For they said, we shall all be dead. Get rid of them or we're all going to die. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls being bound up in their cloaks and their shoulders. The people of Israel had also done as Moses told them, for they had asked the Egyptians for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have what they asked. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. And the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth. About 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. A mixed multitude also went up with them, and very much livestock, both flocks and herds. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough that they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. The time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, on that very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It was a night of watching by the Lord to bring them out of the land of Egypt. So this same night is a night of watching kept to the Lord by all the people of Israel throughout their generations. So we'll stop there because then the rest of chapter 12 goes into the Passover, which we've already talked about. Again, it's just this back and forth content in these chapters. So what I want to focus on here are two issues, and I've already mentioned them, the large numbers problem and the issue of how long was the sojourn in Egypt, which is related to the overall chronological discussion. So let's take them in order. First issue really derives from verse 37, and I'll read it again, Exodus 12, 37. And the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot. Besides women and children. And then, of course, you know, besides the flocks too and the herds. So, this huge number and these kinds of numbers are going to show up elsewhere, like when they take a census and there's actually, you know, two censuses, you know, before, you know, a different book, you have book of Numbers, you know, you have both of these. And, you know, when they are about to go in the land, they fail. And then they you know, renumber the people after the 40 years of wandering and so on and so forth. So you get these large numbers that pop up in the Exodus and the wilderness wandering narratives. And this is a famous, and I would say a very real problem. Now, Carpenter in his commentary just mentions this. He says, the number of persons involved is huge, so huge, in fact, that it has tried the genius of exegetes for centuries as to how to interpret the figure of 600,000 men on foot apart from women, children, women, and other men of various age groups. So there's even other men, you know, the ones that are too old to be among, you know, the, you know, what you would think of as those who can walk this kind of distance. And, you know, again, that's not to mention the animals too. Carpenter continues and he says, various attempts have been made to deal with the figures. The number 600,000 may be of theological importance if it is not textually corrupt. The issue must be seen as an interpretive one, not one of belief or unbelief in God's ability to rescue a certain number of people. God's actions and words created the universe, a project of unfathomable proportions. That act indicates that he has the power over all creation. The theological perspective and literary purpose of the text are the key to understanding the writer, as well as any attempt to understand how large numbers functioned in the literature of the New Kingdom of Egypt, or even in the ancient Near Eastern world in general. We are dealing with certain historical facts. The facts are necessary, but the religious and theological significance they bear is most important. Are the numbers to be taken literally? Are they to be read symbolically, but in some sense of the term, in which the reality of the world of the author is the controlling referent? Or are they the perfect fulfillment in theological terms of God's promise to Abraham concerning his descendants? What reality is being referred to, since biblical reality encompasses history and the divine sphere, and the covenantal world of Israel as well? The meta-narrative of Israel's God intersects with the cultural world of Israel at this time to convey both historical and meta-historical truth. Now, that's kind of academies in the way, you know, that that's put. What I'm going to do at this point, I'm going to read something I wrote for the Faith Life Study Bible about the large numbers problem, and then I'm going to go to an article by a guy I know. In fact, this guy was my first Hebrew teacher at Dallas. He actually did his dissertation on the large numbers problem. So I'm going to be referencing both these things, but let's just jump in here. I think this is a bit more readable, and I think a bit more illustrative of the fact that this is a very real problem. This is not a contrived problem or, you know, some sort of dumb argument from skeptics. This is a real problem. So in the Faith Life Study Bible, I wrote this. This is one of those, you know, excursus parts of the study Bible. In the census following the Exodus from Egypt, Numbers 146, the number of Israelite males older than 20 years of age is 603,550. At the second census, Numbers 26:51, there are 601,730. Now, those are just the men 20 years of age, okay, and older. These figures imply that the total population of the fledgling nation of Israel was somewhere between 2 and 3 million. While these figures are difficult to reconcile with the geography of Canaan and the archaeological record, several solutions, you know, are possible. At least that this is what, you know, people have tried to do. Now, let me just stop there. The issue with the geography of Canaan and the archaeological record are things like this. I'll just telegraph this point. There are certain roads that the Israelites could have taken, like to cross the desert, you know, in different places. Initially, they're like between towns. They go from this point, they turn to that point, and they turn again, and so on and so forth. Geographically, in many of these places, there just isn't room. Literally, there isn't room, spatial area, for this many people to turn more than like three or four people abreast. If you've got 2 to 3 million people, it would take weeks or months just to get past a single signpost point. You know, it's like the Three Stooges, you know, the three of them try to get through the same doorway at the same time and they clog the doorway. That's what you're dealing with in certain points of the geography, you know, along this route that we're given in the Torah, in Exodus, Numbers, or, you know, other places. They literally would have to, okay, no more than three or four across here to, you know, and plus then you got the animals too. It would take weeks or months just for the whole lot of them to cross a single place, a single line, you know, where the first person crossed and a month later, then the last of them to get to that point. There literally isn't enough time in the Exodus itinerary for that kind of thing to happen. by the Bible's own record of things. So it's a real problem. Archaeologically, once they get into the land, if you're dealing with this many people, well, then logically, you would need a certain number of cities or towns or villages where they live. It would be tens of thousands of them. But you don't have that. You don't have anywhere, you know, you might have a few hundred, okay? You don't have anywhere close in terms of settled towns from the archaeological record that can accommodate these numbers. So this is a real problem. It's not a contrived problem. Now, to illustrate this, I also wrote this, The Problem Illustrated. Several passages present challenges to the large figures of the book of Numbers. And of course, here we have in Exodus 12 as well. Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 7 presents Israel, now get this, as the least numerous nation in Canaan at the time of the conquest. It actually says and lists seven other nations that were larger. This means that if the figures in Numbers are to be taken literally, that the total population of these eight nations collectively would have to range from 16 to 24 million people, roughly the 2010 population of Florida or Texas, respectively. The size of Canaan, however, is closer to that of New Jersey than either of those states. So take the whole population of Texas and stick it in New Jersey, and assume that every square foot of it is livable, and you can see the problem. There's just not enough room. And you need water, so you can't just have every square foot occupied. You got cattle. Where are they going to, you know, I mean, are you riding them the whole time? I mean, it's a comedy. It's ridiculous to imagine this at these numbers. There literally isn't the square footage, the square mileage in this place that we call Canaan to have eight nations, the smallest of which is like roughly 3 million. So there's just something going on here. Further considerations help put the problem into perspective. If you go back, this is again from the Faith Life Study Bible. The Israelites left Egypt with, quote, about 600,000 men on foot besides dependents, Exodus 12:37. God did not provide the Israelites with manna until roughly 45 days later, Exodus 16, verse 1, meaning that 2 to 3 million people required a different food source for 45 days. If a family of five sacrificed one lamb or some other animal each day to feed themselves, because they don't have farms, folks. This is a migrant community, all right? If a family of five sacrificed one lamb or some other animal each day to feed themselves, the Israelites would have to slaughter 120,000 lambs every day, meaning the Israelites would have to have left Egypt with 5.4 million animals. Even if they ate meat only a third of the time, like you know, for 15 of those of the 45 days, they still would have had to slaughter 40,000 animals per day and leave Egypt with 1.8 million animals. I mean, can you imagine the poop? I mean, it's untenable. And let's be honest, it just doesn't work. The manna also compounds the issue. According to Exodus 16, 13 to 21, there was enough manna on the ground to feed each Israelite every day. Now that's a really amazing trick because basically the ground is covered with people. It's like standing room only. The Israelites gathered an average of one omer, roughly 2 quarts of manna each day. Exodus 16, 16, and 17. This implies that 1 to 1.5 million gallons of manna appeared on the ground every day. Finally, the Old Testament itself hints that the 2 to 3 million number is unlikely. In Numbers 33:49, it is noted that the Israelites, quote, camped by the Jordan from Beth Jeshimoth up to Abel Shittim on the desert plain of Moab, unquote. Since Beth Jeshimoth and Abel Shittim were approximately 7 miles from each other, the area of the Israelite encampment would have been about 49 square miles. Now, did you hear that? 49 square miles. You got to fit 2 to 3 million people plus the animals in 49 square miles. By comparison, New York City, which had a population of 8.1 million in 2010, covers 305 square miles. Taking the number 2 to 3 million at face value therefore requires that the Israelite camp had a slightly greater population density than New York City without any multi-level living accommodations. They're not building skyscrapers, folks. They're not even building two-floor houses. They're in tents. They're all on the ground. Again, this is a real problem. The numbers are just crazy. Now, my friend Dave Fouts, and we have a link to this article posted on the episode website because this article is available free online. The article is entitled "A Defense of the Hyperbolic Interpretation of Large Numbers in the Old Testament" from the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, Volume 40, Number 3, in 1997. It's about a 10-page article. So I'm gonna draw from this article, but the article itself is drawn from Dave's dissertation. This is what he did his dissertation on at Dallas Seminary. And in the dissertation and in the article, he provides some other telling and I think a bit humorous examples where taking the large numbers literal in the Old Testament just doesn't work by the Bible's own record. Now, here are some of what he illustrates this with. For example, the number of Levites and of Israelite firstborn. I mean, this is the kind of stuff you'd never think of unless you were noodling this problem, okay? Numbers 3 records several large numbers that cause problems if taken at face value. Concerning the number of Levites, three group totals are given, the sum of which is 22,000. It's Numbers 3:39. The sum as given is incorrect. It should be 22,300. The number of all Israelite firstborn is given as 22,273. That's Numbers 3:43, with 273 being the excess above the number of the Levites. Okay, G.B. Gray, who's an Old Testament commentator, has pointed out that this would yield at least 25 sons per family given a population of between 2 and 3 million persons. So if you're going to take the 2 and 3 million at face value, that means every family had 25 boys, again, not to mention the girls. So he says the figures do indeed appear to be difficult if taken at face value. Here's another example. The number of Ephraimites in Judges 12. Judges 12:6 states that for mispronouncing Shibboleth, 42,000 Ephraimites were slain at the River Jordan, a number that exceeds the census total for the entire tribe in either Numbers 1, there it's at 40,500, or Numbers 26, there it's 32,500. Even allowing for an increase of the Ephraimite warrior population after the conquest does not alleviate the problem of the enormity of the number of those slain. So you really can't kill more than actually exist, is the problem. The number is obviously artificial for some reason. Another example, the wall at Aphek. 1 Kings 20, verse 30 asserts that after Israel had killed 100,000 Syrian foot soldiers at a nearby battle, 27,000 more fled into the city of Aphek, where a wall fell on them, apparently killing them as well. I mean, if you just read it, that's the suggestion. One would think that this wall or its remains would be somewhat comparable to the Great Wall of China, to be so calamitous in its collapse that it would have been at least partially unearthed by now. In other words, this wall, to kill 27,000 people, this wall has to be really long. And the question then arises, well, Aphek's been excavated. Where's like this wall that's like a mile or a couple miles or a few miles long? I mean, you know, Fouts compares it to the Great Wall of China to make the point. It's got to be a really long wall to kill this many people. Again, it just sounds kind of absurd. You know, again, if you take the numbers at face value. If there is some other significance to the large numbers, Fouts says, however, the size of the wall may not matter. And again, this is where he's going to go you know, into his solution. But before we get there, I want to go back to what I wrote in the Faith Life Study Bible and say, you know, just give you a bit of an overview here before I head back into Fouts. So again, in the study Bible, I wrote, since taking the numbers of the census figures at face value yields these issues, of course, and others, I'm just being selective here. Several solutions have been proposed. And so on proposed solutions, this is the way I sketched it out. According to the most frequently cited proposal, the Hebrew word for thousand, eleph, may also mean tribe or clan. For example, Numbers 10:4, Judges 6:5, 1 Samuel 10:19. If so, the numbers may simply refer to military units, which corresponds to the aim of the censuses to determine the number of males eligible for Israel's army. The chapters in Numbers that record the censuses then use eleph as both a number and a term for a unit. However, the only examples where eleph might plausibly refer to something other than a number have nothing to do with counting. I mean, if you actually look them up, this is the problem you run into. Moreover, in other passages that do involve counting, for example, Exodus 18:21, 1 Samuel 8:12, 2 Samuel 18:1, the term does not have any other meaning than mathematical tabulation, in other words, a thousand. Another proposal claims that the author of Numbers deliberately exaggerated the numbers, and of course this would be the author of Exodus as well, doing the same thing. They deliberately exaggerated the numbers associated with the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings. In other words, they represent literary hyperbole. Comparisons with other ancient Semitic texts of similar genres, like military annals, validate this suggestion. Ancient Sumerian, Akkadian, and Assyrian literature, particularly royal, inscriptional, and historical annals, deliberately employed hyperbole regarding large numbers. The annals aimed to glorify the God of the king by exaggerating the king's victories. In fact, the biblical accounts of the Exodus and conquest bear striking similarities to contemporary annals in many ways. Given this, the hyperbolic use of numbers in the Old Testament anchors the biblical text to the writing conventions of the time. Now, let me read that over. Given this, if we assume that the numbers here are deliberately exaggerated, they're hyperbole, okay? The hyperbolic use of numbers in the Old Testament anchors the biblical text to the writing conventions of the time. This is an argument that favors their authenticity as truly ancient documents. The writer of these accounts thus could have used a known literary device to draw attention to the might of Yahweh, the King of Kings, earthly or divine, in delivering his people, Israel. Now, this is where Fouts goes. This is Fouts's view, and his article defends the hyperbolic use of numbers in the Old Testament. And what he writes, I'll just cite a few things from him. He says in section 5, use of large numbers in other ancient Near Eastern contexts, he writes this: quite often, large numbers were employed in a hyperbolic fashion in the historiographic literatures of Sumer, Akkad, and Assyria, particularly in the royal, inscriptional, and annalistic genres. The hyperbolic numbers occur in military contexts, expressing the number of troops engaged in battle, the number of enemies slain or captured, the amount of spoil taken, the amount of corvée labor employed. It is evident from my study, says Fouts, that no other culture used numbers in excess of 100,000 with the same frequency as does the Old Testament. Where numbers in excess of 100,000 do occur, they are found exclusively in military contexts, or, you know, something to do with, again, like an Exodus. But basically what he's saying is the numbers are large there, and because the numbers are going to be large in the census, because it has to do with not ultimately fleeing Egypt, but the number of people that are going to be, or the fact that the land, the promised land, needs to be conquered. That's why, you know, we get these large numbers in there. He's saying even the flight from Egypt, those people are ultimately going to be the people, or are intended to be the people, who are going to conquer the land. So you still have this conquest, this militaristic sort of flavor going on in the bigger picture. What Fouts does is he goes to Akkadian examples, Sargon I, Ramush of Akkad, Shalmaneser I, Tukulti Ninurta I, and so on and so forth. He has a number of these. And he writes this: the language of this epic literature is, of course, hyperbolic. One notes the terms, quote, without number, unquote, end quote, beyond counting, unquote, in synonymous parallelism to the specific numbers. And the example he uses here has the number at 3 million. So he says, this may support the hypothesis of my dissertation that at times the large numbers in other genres are also to be understood as literary hyperbole. Two of his main points are, scripture is similar to other ancient historiography in that it may use large numbers hyperbolically in these contexts, and scripture is similar to other ancient historiography in that the ostensible purpose of this usage is to demonstrate the relative magnitude of a given leader or king. Yahweh is greater than David, who is greater than Solomon, who is greater than Rehoboam, who is greater than others, and so on and so forth. This is why the numbers change and they get smaller and so on and so forth. Now, his conclusion is this. I'll just read it to you. One must wonder what implications the results of this study could have on Old Testament scholarship, particularly in the area of conquest models. As has been noted earlier, the large numbers have often been a stumbling block for accepting the biblical accounts as legitimate records of history. If the numbers are simply reflective of a rhetorical device common in ancient Near Eastern literature, however, one may no longer question the integrity of the record by use of this argument. In other words, he's saying, if the hyperbolic view is correct, then critics cannot use the large numbers to say that the accounts are unhistorical, because the writers would be using exactly the same conventions as the writers of military annals from Sumer and Akkad and so on, and all the, you know, Babylon, all these other places, Assyria, that everybody accepts as historical. If the biblical writers are doing the same thing, then the numbers shouldn't matter. They're not disqualifiers for authenticity or historicity. That's Fouts's big point here. He says, the large numbers are often simply figures of speech employed to magnify King Yahweh, King David, or others in a theologically based historiographical narrative. For us, again, this is me speaking now, you know, we're done with Fouts, but you know, for us, we look at that, and when what Fouts has just said, I think is a really good point. I think he's really onto something here, that it is illegitimate to use the problem of the numbers to say that these accounts in the Torah cannot be historical. That is bogus, again, Fouts's point, because this other material that no one questions reflect actually real events. They do exactly the same thing. And everybody knows that this is a literary convention for this other ancient Near Eastern material. So why then exclude the Bible from that same rhetorical or literary technique? If you're going to be consistent and say that it's a product of its own time, then this is no longer an argument against biblical historicity. It's actually an argument in favor of it. But for us, you know, I would tell people, if you're just breaking into the series, go back to the first episode we did on Exodus when we talked about history and historicity, you know, how we think about history. You know, for us, we're not expecting that, since this isn't the way we do military chronicling. It feels like, for us, it feels like exaggeration takes away from historicity. But what Fouts is actually arguing is that no, it actually confirms it, because it puts the Old Testament into the same category as this other stuff that people don't question. And if you're going to just pick on the Old Testament, well, then you're inconsistent. Then you have some sort of religious axe to grind, or some worldview axe to grind, or whatever. But again, to me, that makes very good sense, what he's arguing here for. But I'm just, you know, for the sake of our audience here, for us, we just don't think of history this way. You know, we're not expecting that. Because if we were to write a history of any big war today or any big event, you know, like we're like combing the records, you know, to get the exact body count and all, you know, because that's just the way we do things. They didn't. Nobody in the ancient Near East did. So for the original biblical world, literate readers in that world were expecting this. They knew exactly what was going on with these inflated numbers. It was a familiar way of history writing for them. They would not have felt deceived, since the point wasn't mathematical accuracy, but ultimately glorification of the king or the military leader or the deity, you know, behind those guys. A precise count wasn't even in the picture for either the writers or their original readers. everybody knows what's going on. Everybody sort of knows the rules of the game. They know the rule, the rhetorical rules of the genre. You know, literate readers know what their writers are doing. It conforms perfectly to their expectations, but it doesn't conform to ours at all. So we have a decision to make. Are we going to let the Bible be what it is, or are we going to wish it were something that it wasn't or isn't and was never intended to be? Do we bend it to our will, our expectation? And again, I think this is another area where I've said it before, I'll say it again. When you do that, when you make the Bible conform to your expectations, the way you would do things, you make it vulnerable. You make it an easy target. If you let it be what it is and try to understand it the way that the writers were thinking and the way that the readers were thinking what they received from the writers, you know, there's a coherence to it. There are reasons why these things are the way they are. They're thinking one set of ideas. They're not thinking of the other set of ideas that we might be thinking. We're different. We're different from them. They're not us. And so what this means, you know, for us is that while we read Old Testament accounts, we can't presume to have a real body count, as it were. You know, like if we went back with a calculator and spreadsheet, you know, and put boots on the ground and counted everybody, you know, like it would all come out literally the same if we did that, if we did time travel and everybody was armed with Excel spreadsheets or something. So we can't know that, but we can know that Israel had great victories and God had fulfilled his promise to multiply Abraham's descendants like the stars of the heavens, which again is another hyperbole. I mean, you know, just taking the numerical approach, and I realize, you know, we've had David Burnett on here before, and with the stars of heaven, again, that's not only a numerical thing, a numerical metaphor. It's also a qualitative metaphor, you know, but I don't want to drift off into earlier episodes of the podcast. But if you're just thinking, you know, numerically, that's a hyperbole, like the stars in the heaven. You know, and everybody knows that. Everybody knows it's not supposed to be an exact, precise number. Everybody knows that. Well, in the ancient world, these inflated numbers were like, they were sort of like these sorts of expressions. They were intentional. They had a goal to accomplish, and that was the glorification of the king or the military leader or their god or gods. And everybody knew that. So nobody was surprised. Everybody knew what they had on their hands. The second issue, let's transition to the second issue, derives from verse 40. And again, here we get to go muck around in the chronological stuff again. So let me read verses 40 through 41. So after we get this description of the mixed multitude and the big numbers and all that stuff and the animals, we read this, Exodus 12, 40, 41. The time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years, on that very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Okay? Now the verse deals, specifically verse 40, deals with the length of the sojourn in Egypt, you know, the length of Israel being in Egypt. It appears to be in conflict with other verses and therefore creates problems for Israelite chronology. Here are the other verses. In Galatians, in the New Testament, Galatians 3:17, Paul says, "This is what I mean. The law, which came 430 years afterward, does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God so as to make the promise void." So you say, well, 430 years afterwards, after what? Well, if we actually go to Galatians 3, what precedes verse 17, we read this, "The promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring." It does not say into offsprings, referring to many, but referring to one, and to your offspring, who is Christ. This is what I mean, the law that came 430 years afterwards. So that sets the time at the 430 years there are really sort of looping Abraham in when Abraham received the promises. But that isn't what Exodus 12 says. Exodus 12 says the time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. So where is Paul getting this 430 years? Why is he including Abraham? It doesn't align. Another example, it appears in conflict with Genesis 15, 13 through 16. So let's just go there. I'll go back to verse 13. "Then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. It's not 430, 400 years. "But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, You shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here. They, you know, these, your offspring, shall come back here in the fourth generation. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Okay, so it seems to equate the 400 with four generations. So a generation of 100 years. When you have four of them, you got 400 years. But that's not 430. Then you have Acts 7:6. This is part of Stephen's speech. God spoke to this effect that his offspring would be sojourners in a land belonging to others who would enslave them and afflict them for 400 years. So that seems to be drawing on Genesis 15, verse 13 through 16. There's another one, Acts 13:20, but we'll get to that in a moment. That's a bit different. So what we have here, though, is we have Exodus 12:40 and 41 in the Masoretic text, traditional text, saying that the people of Israel lived in Egypt 430 years. So what do we do with the extra 30 years that seems to be in conflict with Genesis 15, which of course lies behind Acts 7? You know, when we really think about it, we also have a problem with Galatians 3:16 and 17 because he loops Abraham in as well, Paul does. So we have numbers 400 and 430 that have slightly different contexts, and of course the numbers themselves are different. So what's going on here? Like, what do we do that? You know, what do we do with that? Well, there are a couple of ways to approach this. You might think, first of all, just, you know, one approach. Wouldn't it be nice if instead of Exodus 12:40 saying the time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years, instead of it saying that, it said something like, now the sojourn of the children of Israel, during which they dwelt in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, was 430 years. Wouldn't that be nice? Because that, in other words, that would loop Abraham and his time in Canaan into the 430 years. And that would seem to agree with Paul. Wouldn't it be nice if the text just said that? Well, guess what? It does in the Septuagint. What I just read to you was Rolf's edition of the Septuagint. That's what it says. Now, other manuscripts of the Septuagint actually have 435, but at least we have a Septuagint tradition that has 430 and loops Abraham into the picture. So you could say that Paul was evidently using a Septuagint that was basically, again, what I just read about they dwelled in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan. That phrase is added, okay, 430 years. So Paul in Galatians 3:16 and 17 and Exodus 12:40 would actually agree in this scenario. Paul is essentially paraphrasing the content of the Septuagint, which loops the patriarchs into the number of Exodus 12:40. Well, that would be nice, but we still have to deal with what about the 400 number in other passages, Genesis 15, 13 through 16 and Acts 7, verse 6. Can we reconcile this 430 and Abraham's in the loop here? So that takes care of the 430, at least it seems to. And then what about the 400? Well, go back to the Genesis passage and listen to it closely. Here's how you would do, how you would reconcile these things. Verse 13, then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be their servants and be afflicted for 400 years. They see what I did there. I could say, well, in Genesis 15, 13, God is talking to Abraham and he doesn't loop Abraham into the number, into the number of the sojourning. He tells Abraham, look, your offspring, your descendants will be sojourners in a land for 400 years. So it's not you. So that kind of opens the door for a time in Egypt less than 430 that we could say, well, maybe 400. We could postulate that the 400 years in Genesis 15, 13 through 15 refers to the actual bondage, the bad time in Egypt. Well, 430 would be, you know, maybe a time that, you know, we could say Jacob and his descendants lived in Egypt and it wasn't bad at all. You know, after all, there was an interval between the time Jacob and his family get there and the time in Exodus 1 where things start to really go bad. Well, there are problems here too, because not only, again, if we're depending on the Septuagint and we're looking back at Paul, Paul is still obviously kind of thinking of Abraham in some way here. And we can't get Abraham within 30 years of the lifetime of Jacob. So we still have that problem. And Exodus 1 seems to suggest that the enslavement situation came toward the tail end of Israel's time in Egypt. Or it could be read that way. It doesn't have to be read that way. Maybe, again, a better way to take it is that, you know, the period of affliction, maybe it did last 400 years. Because as we read Exodus 1, you know, Exodus 1, you know, says, hey, there arose a Pharaoh that didn't know Joseph. Again, that's shortly after Jacob dies. And things just go sour progressively. You know, it starts out one way and then it ends with, you know, slavery and killing the Israelite boys and all, you know, it just gets worse. So maybe it does stretch out 400 years. Maybe we're okay. But again, you know, we're getting closer to a reconciliation, but we're still not quite there. Because we have the Abraham thinking in Paul's head. Maybe Paul is, this is possible, because the New Testament writers do this. Maybe Paul is thinking of both passages, both Genesis 15 and Exodus 12, and just summarizing, paraphrasing, and putting them both together. That's why he thinks of Abraham, the time, you know, where the covenant was launched, and the 400 years of bondage there. And he's also thinking of Exodus 12, you know, the 430, you know, making maybe that's Jacob's early good time. He was still in Egypt, but it wasn't in bondage, and they were only afflicted 400. I mean, you could see how these things could, you know, get mixed, not in a wrong way, but you could see how Paul could be thinking of all these passages and sort of just shorthanding it in Galatians 3 to just present a summary in the space of a verse, you know, two verses, you know, what happened here. I mean, you can get there. You can sort of deal with the 400 and the 430, you know, that way. Now, Sarna, in his Exodus commentary, notes that the rabbinic material puts kind of an interesting twist on this. He says, the first part is already familiar to us, but I'm going to read it anyway. The historical summation of verses 40 and 41, this is Exodus 12, do not exactly accord with the 400 years of Egyptian oppression predicted in Genesis 15, 13. The Mekhiltah, and by the way, that's a compilation of essentially Jewish legal theory, halakhic midrash on the book of Exodus. The Mekhiltah resolves the discrepancy by attributing the 30-year difference to the interval between God's covenant with Abraham and the birth of Isaac. So it brings Isaac into the picture. Although the text, Sarna admits, speaks clearly enough only of the Egyptian episode, doesn't really say anything about Isaac. The inclusion of the sojourn in Canaan in the computation is explicit in the text of the Septuagint, which we already, you know, read, and also the Samaritan Pentateuch. Now, that isn't really helpful because that sort of just tells us what we already know. Here's the interesting part. Here's the interesting twist that Sarna sort of triangulates for. He notes that maybe the numbers, again, aren't to be taken at face value, but they are what they are because of a preference, a literary preference for mathematical symmetry. Now, catch this. This is Sarna again. He writes, Ibn Ezra, again, a famous rabbinic teacher, begins the 430-year reckoning with the departure of Abraham from Haran for Canaan. And in fact, exactly 215 years elapsed between that event and Jacob's migration to Egypt, yielding the same time span for the stay of the Israelites in Egypt. So you have 215 years on one side and 215 years on the other. And of course, you put them together, and that equals 430. Sarna writes, this kind of symmetry follows a symmetrical pattern well established in the patriarchal narratives and elsewhere in the book of Genesis. Thus, Abraham lived 75 years in the home of his father and 75 years in the lifetime of his son Isaac. He was 100 years of age at the birth of Isaac, and he lived 100 years in Canaan. Jacob lived 17 years with Joseph in Canaan and a like period with him in Egypt. 10 generations separated Noah from Adam, and another 10 generations from Abraham to Noah. In the light of these facts, it may be that the neatly balanced periods of time are intended to be rhetorical rather than literal. That is, they underline the biblical ideal of history as the fulfillment of God's deliberate design. In the worldview of the Bible, history cannot be merely a series of disconnected and haphazard events, unquote. That's the end of Sarna. So basically, Sarna is saying maybe we ought to think about the numbers being what they are because the writer wants to tie two sections of you know, of God's work on earth through the patriarchs or through his people Israel or through, you know, Adam to Noah or whatever, that the numbers are what they are to specifically connect two equal halves in terms of their numerical, of the numerical number given to each half. Maybe that's intentional. Maybe they're supposed to be brought together. Maybe the number given to them, people are supposed to discern that if you cut the number in half, then you look for both halves somewhere else in the chronological comments, the like the age years given for people or between, you know, events, just so that you're supposed to connect the two sets. And it's not about a literal chronology or historical chronology in terms of time on earth. Maybe that's not the point. Maybe the point is, again, to bring two things together because they're equal halves. Now, that's fascinating. And again, my judgment would be that's really worth thinking about. I don't know that that's the case here with the number 430, but it's actually pretty interesting. So if you like that idea, the solution there, therefore, to Exodus 12:40 would be simple for you, or you might think. The solution might be, you know, easy enough. Well, you know, we've got 430 years. It's an artificial artificial number in terms of like literal chronology, but it connects these two things. That number is chosen for symmetry. Again, that seems to work because we have other symmetrical patterns that, you know, emerge when we're looking for this kind of thing in scripture. But again, if you're going to go that route, if you take that approach, it does call into general question the literalness of the numbers. In other words, could other numbers associated with the Exodus and Israelite history be artificial for the same symmetrical, literary, rhetorical, theological purposes? I mean, we have this in the New Testament very obviously in the genealogy of Jesus. In Matthew, you have the three sets of 14. Again, there's a deliberate reason why it's structured that way. It skips generations if you compare that genealogy back to the Old Testament material. There's a symmetry created there in the three sets, and there's also a gematria thing that emerges from the way the numbers are arranged and all that sort of stuff. It points to David, but again, I don't want to get into that in this episode. But there are things like this that happen. So, you know, you look at that and you say, well, okay, maybe 430 is 215 plus 215, and we don't really know if we should attach real time to that or not. But if you do, if you decide, well, I want to have my cake and eat it too, I kind of like that explanation, but I still want the 430 and the 215s, you know, to mean something. And I'm going to keep them for historical markers, you know, chronology and real time. If you do that, then you must embrace the late date of the Exodus. And Archer, Gleason Archer, who was not a late dater, saw this very clearly. He writes in his book, Survey of Old Testament Introduction, he says, as to the length of the sojourn of the Israelites in Egypt, the clear statement of the Hebrew text of Exodus 12:40 is that it totaled 430 years from the migration of Jacob's family until the Exodus itself. But since the Septuagint here reads that the 430 years included the sojourn of Abraham and his descendants into Canaan as well as Egypt, some have preferred this variant to the reading of the Masoretic text. Some like the Septuagint better. This would result in a specifically Egyptian sojourn of about 215 years. Okay, so if you're going to take this, the second half of the 215 as literal chronological history, then you have a sojourn of 215 years. And if you plug that into real time, guess what? Archer writes, that would bring Joseph's career squarely into the Hyksos period. And that is precisely what the late date advocates. Joseph was part of the Hyksos period. Late date, the date of the Exodus is in the 13th century BC, the 1200s somewhere. So Archer realizes this. And again, he's going to argue against the Septuagint reading. He's going to argue against, you know, adopting the 430 and all this kind of stuff because, you know, Archer is committed to the early date in his introduction. Now, Hoffmeyer, who is a late dater, says this. Paul allots 430 years between Abrahamic and the Sinaitic covenants, or the time between Abraham and the Exodus, indicating that he followed the Septuagint chronology. He has a footnote here. According to the Masoretic text chronology, 645 years separate the two, okay, between the Abrahamic and the Sinai covenants. 645 years, according to the Masoretic text. Exodus 12:40 has a different reading in the Septuagint than does the Masoretic text. The Septuagint envisions two periods of 215 years totaling 430. 215 years spent by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in Canaan prior to the families moved to Egypt, and 215 years in Egypt prior to the Exodus. So it's quite a variance between the two textual traditions. And what Hofmeyer does with this is he says, look, Paul used the Septuagint, so I'm good with that. You know? And of course, Hofmeyer's a late dater anyway. But again, to be fair to him, it seems like he really genuinely does consider this fairly compelling, that, you know, Paul has this specific chronology in his head. And if you're going to adopt that chronology as real-time chronological history, then Joseph is a Hyksos, and that you can only have the Exodus in the 13th century. Now, again, next week in the next episode, we're going to talk about how the early date and the late date defend each other and respond to each other. But I'm just telling you right now, the problem already sort of emerges right here. And it really did back in Exodus 1 when we talked about Ramesses and the names and Pithom and Ramesses and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to deal with that again and hopefully put some closure to it, at least in terms of the coverage next week. So if you adopt a late date Exodus, you're done now. You're good with the Septuagint. You know how you're going to handle Exodus 12:40, how you're going to read that verse in relation to Genesis 15. You're good with what Paul does. You're good. But what if you don't like the late date? Okay. Well, that means you've got to stay with the Masoretic text. And the Masoretic text says we've got 430 years. That's the number given in Exodus 12:40 and Galatians 3:16 and 17. And then we have a 400-year number in Genesis 15, 13 through 16, and Acts 7, 6. So your strategy would be this. He would say, okay, the Exodus 12:40 reference, 430 years, quote, this is a direct quote from Exodus 12:40, of the Israelites living in Egypt. So that can only be understood as the time when Jacob gets there, okay, through the bondage, and then the Exodus happens. Okay, so you've got 430 years. You got to go with that. Then Genesis 15, you would say, well, that refers to 400 years of affliction. You could say, well, the 30 years, maybe the extra 30 years in Exodus 12, verse 40, maybe that refers to the time when Jacob's there, he's with Joseph, and they're not living under affliction. They're not in bondage. You know, it's a normal, you know, kind of relationship. And when things start to go sour from that, the point that they start to go sour all the way to the Exodus, well, that's 400 years. So that's how you would have to read this. So, and we've already covered, you know, some of that ground earlier. So this is how you would have to handle things. Now, the only outlier here is, what do I do with Abraham? Because again, Galatians 3:16 and 17 seems to suggest that Abraham is lurking in Paul's head when he's referencing 430 years. And again, I've already told you what you'd have to do here, but just to summarize it again, you'd have to say, look, the reason why Paul mentions these things, Abraham in verse 16, the giving of the Abrahamic covenant, and then he goes into the 430 years, is because Paul has both passages, both Genesis 15 and Exodus 12 in his head, and he's just summarizing things in Galatians 3:16 and 17. That's essentially what you have to do. You have to assume that Paul's paraphrase of the text is not designed to loop Abraham into the 430 years. It's incidental to the 430 years. So take your pick. You know, if you like that view and you stick with the Masoretic text, then you can still argue for the early date of the Exodus. If you want to say, I don't think that's what Paul was thinking, I think Paul is looping this stuff together, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I'm going to go with the Septuagint. That means Joseph is in the Hyksos period and we have to have a late date Exodus. Well, good for you. Again, both of these things are possible. I'm giving you both trajectories on how you would have to deal, again, with the data. Now, there's a couple outliers here. Isn't that wonderful? One outlier is Acts 13:20. It's not really a big one. Neither of these are lethal to anything, but they might occur to somebody listening in the audience. Acts 13:20 says this, and I'm actually going to read verses 16 through 20. So Paul stood up and motioning with his hand, again, this is when Paul, you know, is in trouble again, like he usually is. Okay, so he wants to speak to the crowd. Men of Israel, and you who fear God, listen. The God of this people Israel chose our fathers and made the people great during their stay in the land of Egypt. And with uplifted arm, he led them out of it. And for about 40 years, he put up with them in the wilderness. And after destroying seven nations in the land of Canaan, he gave them their land as an inheritance. all this took about 450 years. And after that, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. So the 450 years here for Paul means this. It's the time from, well, let me just ask, you know, what it means. The 450 years, look at the phrases Paul uses, that God chose our fathers. Now, does that include Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or is it just a generic reference to the Israelites who have gone before us? Then he has the phrase, their stay in the land of Egypt. Okay, that's a clear reference to the sojourn in Egypt, period of affliction. Then he references 40 years of wandering. Then he references the conquest. And he says, all that's about 450 years. Now, with respect to our earlier verses that have the numbers 400 and 430 in them, if you took the 400, you know, for the affliction, let's just say that the first phrase chose our fathers. And then as Paul says that, he links it to their stay in the land of Egypt. Let's just interpret that as saying, well, Paul's talking about when the Israelites went into Egypt. Our fathers would be Jacob and his sons, his 12 sons, you know, Israel, okay? And so if you're going to do it that way, and you're going to move Abraham out of the picture, then you would just add the numbers this way. If you're using the 400 as the number for affliction, 400 plus 40 plus 7 is 447. That's about 450 years. If you're using the 430, you'd come up with a total of 477. And you'd have to say, well, yeah, that's about 450 years, a little bit more, but you know, it's not a big deal. Both views would say that the number 450 is an approximation. That's how you would do this. Okay, so either side, you know, that there are your trajectories, you know, pick the one you like. Second outlier, and this issue isn't directly related to the duration of the bondage in our topic, but it is a cautionary tale. Here's why I put it in here. It's a cautionary tale about using the concepts of generations and genealogies to do biblical chronology. And I know everybody says, oh, you just look at the genealogies and the genealogies, just add the numbers up. There you go. You know, the world created in 4004 BC, you know, all that kind of, okay. That's nonsensical. And this is a textbook illustration of why. Okay. So this is a good cautionary tale. As such, it is worthwhile to get into this, how a literal face value reading of years and genealogies may not help at all. If you go to Exodus 6, 16 through 20. Again, we've covered Exodus 6 before, but this is when you get this sort of intrusive genealogy about the Levites, you know, after God has made a concession to Moses, you know, as far as bringing Aaron into the picture and all that, you get this weird genealogy just sort of plopped in here that we've talked about before. Okay, now catch this. This is from Kaiser's book on hard sayings of the Old Testament. He actually has this as one of his entries. He writes on his treatment of this passage, the list of four generations in this text presents no problems on its face until one reads in Exodus 12:40 that the time period is 430 years. Such genealogical lists in the Old Testament have been a source of special delight and enormous difficulty. I'm going to stop there. Let me read verses 16 through 20 and you'll get why this matters for the 430. Here's what we read. These are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations. Now, Levi was one of the 12 offspring of Jacob who went with Jacob into Egypt. Okay, so we're right at the beginning point now of the sojourn or the time of Israel in Egypt, 430. Okay, so these are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations: Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, the years of the life of Levi being 137 years. The sons of Gershon, you know, he lists the sons of Gershon, verse 18, the sons of Kohath, and he gives the list. The sons of Merari, and he gives the list. Then he says, these are the clans of the Levites according to their generations. Amram, who was one of the sons of Kohath, Amram took as his wife Jochebed, his father's sister, and she bore him Aaron and Moses. The years of the life of Amram being 137 years. So we've got four generations written about here. We've got Levi, of course, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. You could say Gershon, Kohath, and Merari plus Amram. Maybe that's the fourth generation, whatever. You've clearly gone from the time the Israelites get into Egypt to the time of Moses and Aaron. And you got these four generations, okay? Now let's go back here, because Kaiser sees a problem. He says, the difficulty is that all too many interpreters have been tempted to assume that these genealogies are complete lists of names and figures, and that we can therefore add up all the ages and obtain absolute dates for a number of pre-patriarchal events for which we otherwise would have no data. Unfortunately, this assumption is faulty. These are not complete genealogical records, and it was not the writer's intention to provide this material for readers who might wish to add up numbers. Usually the text is reluctant to do this. We must be reluctant to do it as well. So we must ask, is there evidence that these genealogies were condensed? Okay. What he's going to do here is he's going, well, let me just skip down here a little bit here. I might as well just read the whole thing. It's not that long. He says here, Is there evidence these genealogies were condensed through the omission of less important names? In particular, can we determine whether there were only four generations? Here's the key question. Were there only four generations from Levi to Moses during the 430 years of bondage in Egypt? Sub-question. Were Amram and Jochebed Aaron and Moses' immediate parents? If not, why does the text say Jochebed bore him, to Amram, Aaron, and Moses? On the other hand, why does Exodus 2:1 remain noncommittal about the names of Moses' parents? Quote, now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman. She became pregnant, gave birth to the son Moses. A parallel genealogy, here's the problem. A parallel genealogy for the same period of time, from the days just before Jacob went to Egypt until his descendants came out 430 years later, is preserved in the line of Joshua, a younger contemporary of Moses. And it's given in 1 Chronicles 7:23 through 27. Yeah, 1 Chronicles is good for something, folks. And here it is. In that line, there are 11 generations listed between Jacob and Joshua. And so what Kaiser's saying is the genealogy that we read in Exodus 6 has to be abbreviated and condensed. It has to be select. It's not going to be reliable to just add up years to get time intervals and event intervals. You got 11 generations and four generations. It's dramatically different. It's not like just one extra, okay, maybe they had an extra kid when she was a little bit younger. No, it's 11 generations between Jacob and Joshua. The logical conclusion, Kaiser writes, is that Moses' genealogy is condensed. It is inconceivable that there should be 11 links between Jacob and Joshua and only four or maybe five between Jacob and Moses. If more proof is needed, we have it. An altogether overwhelming set of data can be seen in Numbers 3, 19, and 27, and 28. If no abridgment is understood in the four generations of Moses' ancestry, catch this, what results is this unbelievable set of numbers. The grandfather of Moses had, during Moses' lifetime, 8,600 male descendants. And we're forgetting that doesn't include the girls. Okay? 2,750 of whom were between the ages of 30 and 50, according to Numbers 4:36. Now, all of us know that these were times of large families, but is it possible to make sense of what has been reported in these texts unless there is a considerable condensing and compression of the record to get at just the key characters? Another piece of evidence is to be found in the fact that Levi's son Kohath was born before Jacob, and his 12 sons went down to Egypt, according to Genesis 46:11, where the emerging nation of Israel lived for 430 years. Now, if Moses was 80 years old at the Exodus, according to Exodus 7:7, he must have been born 350 years after Kohath, who, as a consequence, could not have been his grandfather. In fact, Kohath is said to have lived a total of 133 years, and his son Amram lived 137 years. These two numbers do not add up to the 350. Okay. I mean, he goes on to just point out how if you don't understand that the four generations of Exodus 6 are selective, and you take those names in those four generations, and you go into the book of Numbers, where these people are found, and they're having kids and other kids that aren't mentioned here, and there's other generations, it becomes a numerical set of absurdities. You say, well, what's the point, Mike? The point is that I brought this into the discussion because, in part, to set up next week. So we're going to end here. The issue is doing biblical chronology and arriving at dates for events is not as simple as looking in the Bible for numbers and just getting out a calculator and adding them all up. let's be honest, few people care about the book of Numbers and the genealogical lists of First Chronicles. But there is stuff in there that will mess your chronological approach up big time. It will turn it into a house of cards, because that's what it is. So again, I offer this as a cautionary tale leading up to our discussion of the dates, the two, you know, the big two, the early date and the late date. Because some of that's going to involve, how do we understand generations? How do we understand, do we take numbers literally or not? So in this episode, what we've got is we've got instances of numerical symmetry that makes potentially the numbers somewhat artificial. In other words, they are what they are because the writer wants to unite two sets of things together intentionally for the reader. And we also have, again, a cautionary tale about assuming certain things about genealogical lists when you get into chronology. It is not that simple. It will get you into trouble. It will lead you to false conclusions. So again, with that said, we've just dipped our toe into the issues here. So next time, we're going to build on this and get into the chronology, early and late date. How are they defended, and how does each side respond to each other?
Mike, did you mention which side you come down on all this?
You know, my honest answer is I just don't know. There are things that tug me in both directions. It's really difficult. I'll just give you an example. One of the things that makes the late date unattractive to me are the disconnects with Joseph and the Hyksos period. I mean, they really are disconnected. You know, so I don't quite know. There are always ways, you know, to deal with that, but there are just things that sort of stick out. But on the other hand, the late date does have a number of things that really kind of make sense. Like in this episode, it could allow you to just go with the Septuagint. You don't have to, but you could. There's a whole bigger issue of when they actually get into the conquest, does the description of the geography of the land, what does that look like? Does it look like what we know from archaeology? And I'm not talking about the conquests of like Jericho. I'm talking just about the general settlement, you know, patterns. Does it look more like the 13th century or the 14th century? And you can make a good argument that the boundaries of the cities and all that stuff really look a lot like the 13th century based on Telemarna texts, because Egypt used to be in control of this whole region, and there's actually a lot of records for towns and villages and stuff like that. But is that just evidence of it being written later or updated? Is it editorial? Who knows? I just don't know. I don't really know where to land. On one level, I don't really care. It's almost at eschatology level for me. But since it's mostly Old Testament, I'm a little bit more interested in it than eschatology. Okay. But yeah. It's almost there.
It's okay not to know. I mean, it's all right.
Yeah, I don't think anything hinges on one date or the other. But you know, when we go through next week, people are going to say, that's really persuasive. You got me there, and that's going to happen on both sides, and that's okay. You know, like I said, there are things about each view that tug me and make me, you know, want to side with that particular view. But then something else comes along. It's like, this just sounds better at this point than the other one, and so on and so forth. So I don't know.
Well, I want to hear what people land, where they come down after next week's episode. So be sure to hashtag Naked Bible in social media and let us know. I want to hear the conversation that people are having out there.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
It would be interesting. So use the hashtag Naked Bible out there in social media and let us know where you come down on things after next week's episode. And let's see if we can't get the internet talking about all of this. It'd be good, Mike. Do a little experiment for us.
At least a small set of nerds, you know, Bible nerds talking about
it. Yeah. Hey, better than zero. All right, Mike. Well, we look forward to part two next week. And with that, I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.